Welcome. This is a production of Mission 119 Ministries. My name is Hudson Smelly. We're beginning a brand new series, a short series, through what are sometimes referred to as the Outer Darkness passages. This will be appropriately titled, The Outer Darkness. These are three passages that occur in the Gospel of Matthew, or Matthew 8, 5 to 12, Matthew 22, 1 to 14, and Matthew 25, 14 through 30. We'll spend three or four lessons on this and try to cover one of these key passages in each lesson. The question of, are unfruitful believers excluded from some portion of the millennial kingdom, or are they non-believers who ultimately will spend eternity in the lake of fire? There is a division about these passages among those who identify as free grace. Outside of that, I've rarely heard any dispute about it. It seems that most understand the passages to use outer darkness as an indicator of those who will go to the lake of fire. So this should not be a basis for a break of fellowship, in my opinion. I think it's an interesting issue. I don't know that it's a critically important in the grand scheme of things. I will, as I said, devote about one lesson to each of the key passages and then try to address what I believe is the bias that leads to a more recent interpretation of these passages, that outer darkness is a reference to believers being temporarily excluded from the kingdom. Now, I want to get some context for our passage, but the passage we will be reading from is Matthew 8, 5 to 12. The context begins, in my thinking, with the Sermon on the Mount that begins in Matthew 5. The Sermon on the Mount is Matthew 5 through 7. I just want to give just high-level highlights of this. Jesus begins the Sermon on the Mount, what we call the Beatitudes. This is the first message he provides in Matthew. Matthew is not a chronological gospel, it's a thematic gospel, and you have virtually no red letters before Matthew 5. Here he gives his inaugural address as the Messiah, as it were. It's his first message that's recorded in Matthew, but I do not believe it's that early in his ministry. I think it's late enough that he's already meeting with resistance from the Jewish leadership. We'll see some of that. But it's just important to understand that, because if you were reading along, for example, in John's Gospel, he begins with events that are earlier than the Sermon on the Mount. So Matthew records Jesus saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs." He will repeatedly refer to the kingdom of heaven, occasionally call it the kingdom of God. And it makes a point that I'll come back to momentarily, which is throughout the Gospel of Matthew, there's being in the kingdom or not. There doesn't seem to be a third option. But the interpretation we'll be wrestling with of the outer darkness passages is there a third option? Is there in the kingdom, never in the kingdom, or some that are in the kingdom eventually? A third option. And I would say there's not, but just understand that as you just read it in a natural way, all you see Matthew refer to is being in the kingdom or not. You don't see any explicit explanation of some sort of temporary being out of the kingdom then brought in. Now, the Sermon on the Mount is ultimately about faith. And Jesus says something that would startle his Jewish audience in the first century. When you're reading through in the Sermon on the Mount, he begins with the Beatitudes. And then in verse 20 of chapter 5, he says, "For I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never get into the kingdom of heaven." Now, this gives some indication that Jesus has already butted heads with these guys, and that becomes very apparent as you get to Matthew 9, and Jesus is accused of casting out a demon by the power of Beelzebub. That's an event that will more or less repeat itself in Matthew 12. So Jesus sets a high standard. His audience would have considered the scribes and Pharisees to be righteous because they were so meticulous about the matters of the law. And Jesus says, "You will not be in the kingdom unless your righteousness surpasses theirs." Again, as with all the kingdom passages, it seems to only think of those who are in the kingdom or not a third option. Now, the statement that you have to be more righteous than the Pharisees and scribes raises the question of, well, what's the standard? After he makes that statement, Jesus interprets several commandments from the Old Testament law, but he interprets it in a way that will contradict what the Pharisees would have taught. There was an oral tradition that had developed, so Jesus will say, "You've heard it said, but I tell you." You've heard it said, that's the more rabbinic interpretation, to which he corrects it. He says, "But I say," and he speaks of committing adultery or murder. And what he gets at is, it's not merely the outward conduct, it's what's in your heart. Because someone might say, "Well, I've kept the law from my youth." And Jesus says, it's not just what you do on the outside, it's what's in your heart. And once you figure that out, you realize that there's no way anybody anywhere can honestly claim they've always kept it. So how would they ever be more righteous than these scribes or Pharisees? Well, the standard at the end of chapter 5 is in verse 48, where Jesus says, "Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." He summarizes that section by saying, "Therefore, be perfect." It's a standard they can't reach, and it raises the question, well, what do they do? And I suggest that as he starts to wind up the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 7, he answers this question. This is Matthew 7, 21-23, speaking of the future judgment, which again has to do with who's being in the kingdom and who's not. Jesus says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven." Again, there seems to be two options: those who don't enter and those who do the will of his Father in heaven. What have they done? What is the will of Jesus' Father in heaven? Well, on that day, many will say to me, "Lord, Lord, didn't we prophesy in your name, drive out demons in your name, and do many miracles in your name?" They may or may not have. It's not the point, and Jesus doesn't address whether they really did. What he does address, verse 23, "Then I will announce to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you lawbreakers.'" That's what he says. You have to know him. There has to be this relationship. And what becomes apparent is, this is a relationship because you have placed faith in him as the Christ. And the balance of chapter 8 really is all about this matter of faith. And he addresses faith in a number of ways, but there are so many who have faith in him and others that don't. And so that's what he'll talk about in Matthew 8. So Matthew 8 opens with a miracle. It's the first recorded miracle in Matthew. If you were to read John's Gospel, that first miracle is turning water into wine. That is a much earlier miracle, and it probably really is Jesus' absolute first miracle, as far as we know, happened in Cana. In Matthew 8, because it's thematic, the first miracle is the healing of a leper. There are a few instances of leprosy in the Old Testament that gets healed by God. One is Moses' sister Miriam. You read about that in Numbers 12. But you never have someone healed of leprosy who then has to follow the law of Moses, which was very specific about taking an offering and going to the priest and getting their certification that you are cleansed of the leprosy. This is the only time it happens, the first time it happens. Never happened in the Old Testament. Arnold Fruchtenbaum would call this a messianic miracle, a unique miracle that only Messiah does, that uniquely marks him off to his Jewish audience and especially to the leadership as the Christ. This was a message to the leadership. When he heals this leper, he says in verse 4, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them." It is a message being sent to the leadership in Jerusalem that Messiah is here. What you read about, as I said earlier, immediately is resistance. There's the indication of resistance already in the Sermon on the Mount with Jesus talking about the scribes and Pharisees. And in Matthew 9 and most of the chapters thereafter, you meet this resistance. So that's all there. But we have this faith issue. So let me read the key passage then that we're going to study. "When he entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, 'Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed in terrible agony.' He said to me, 'Am I to come and heal him?' 'Lord,' the centurion replied, 'I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. But just say the word, my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, having soldiers under my command. I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it.' Hearing this, Jesus was amazed and said to those following him, 'Truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with so great a faith. I tell you that many will come from east and west to share the banquet with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus told the centurion, "Go, as you have believed, let it be done for you." And his servant was healed that very moment. So we have a passage here that has two interpretations. One, and I think by far the most common, is that those who are put in outer darkness are excluded from the kingdom, and then by implication, they will spend eternity in the lake of fire. Doesn't mention anything about lake of fire here, but it will mention it later in the gospel, and the implication is excluded from the kingdom, they're going to go to hell. The other interpretation is that the ones excluded from the kingdom, they are called here sons of the kingdom or children of the kingdom, is a reference to believers, and what they're being excluded from is only the feast or the banquet that's being referred to here with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, after which, at some point, they will be permitted to enter the kingdom, either after the feast or even after the entire millennial kingdom. They will get to enter and then spend the eternal state with Christ because they're believers. The idea is argued that the centurion had great faith, and they did not. It wasn't that they had no faith. They just simply didn't have great faith like him, and for that reason, they will spend some period of time in outer darkness as a punishment, if you will, for their not having more faith, and then eventually they'll get in the kingdom. So those are the two ideas. I'm going to give a little more background as we dig into this that will help, I think, understand it. But let me say this. Matthew 8 is all about faith. You read the whole chapter, it's about faith. He heals people, and he talks about your faith has made you whole, that sort of thing. You see that in chapter 9 as well. Matthew is often contrasting the faith that some Gentiles have with a lack of faith among Jewish people. I think that's what's going on here, but I'll give you some more indicators of that. So for example, if you flip to chapter 11, I'm going to read 11:16 to 24. This is important because, again, you see throughout the Gospel of Matthew a resistance from so many of the Jewish people, and especially the leadership, a lack of faith. They're rejecting him as the Christ. So Matthew 11:16 to 24. Jesus says in Matthew 11, "To what should I compare this generation? It's like children sitting in the marketplace who call out to other children, 'We played the flute for you, but you didn't dance. We sang a lament, but you didn't mourn.' For John came, neither eating nor drinking," that's John the Baptist, "and they say he has a demon. For the Son of Man," Jesus' title for himself, "he came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds." Then he proceeded to denounce the towns where most of his miracles were done because they did not repent. What becomes obvious is Jesus is talking about having a group of people, Jewish generation in the first century, having the most revelation of God of any person at any time because they have Jesus in the flesh ministering to them and doing miracles that validate that he's the Christ. And in the face of all of that, there's faithlessness. There's total rejection, not by everybody, but by a lot of people. And yet, he would say, the Gentiles would respond with faith to far less revelation. So, as you read on, he says, "Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the miracles that were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes long ago." These people in the first century had maximum revelation, this Jewish generation, and they don't respond favorably. He says Tyre and Sidon, they would have responded entirely differently and not come under judgment had they seen the same thing. "But I tell you, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon on the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? No, you will go down to Hades. For if the miracles that were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained unto this day. But I tell you, it would be more tolerable for the land of Sodom on the day of judgment than for you." So again, it's you're in the kingdom or you're not. Okay, it's just like with Sodom and Gomorrah. There doesn't seem to be a middle ground. And the issue here is faithlessness. They have not responded in faith to Jesus. And he says, if I had done these miracles, these messianic type miracles, for Gentiles, Tyre and Sidon, Sodom and Gomorrah. This would have turned out all differently. If you go up to chapter 12, there's a similar thing. 12:38. In chapter 12, the turning point where the Jewish leadership accused Jesus of casting out demons by Beelzebub. This is the second time they've done it. And it's a turning point because he pronounces judgment on them and begins in chapter 13 to teach about the kingdom in parables. He is effectively withholding now the offer of the kingdom. In Matthew 12:38, it says, "Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, 'Teacher, we want to see a sign from you.'" Again, he is meeting Jewish people who should have responded in faith to him, especially seeing all the miracles he's done, and they haven't. And my suggestion to you, that's all that's happening back in Matthew 8 in our challenge passage. So Jesus answers these scribes and Pharisees, "An evil and adulterous generation demands a sign." It characterizes that generation. It's not all of them. Jesus' own disciples are obviously Jewish. His apostles are Jewish. But characteristically, this generation will have nothing to do with him. And so he says, "No sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was in the belly of the huge fish 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights. The men of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it." Why? Why would the Ninevites, back from the book of Jonah, be in a position to condemn this Jewish generation in first century Israel? Well, the answer is simple. They had minimal preaching from the prophet Jonah. It's five words in Hebrew. If you go back and read the book of Jonah, five words. God's going to destroy you in 40 days. And the whole city repented in sackcloth and ashes and pleaded to God and made sacrifices. And Jesus says, "But I came to you doing all these signs and miracles, and you didn't go in sackcloth and ashes. You rejected me." So he says, because they repented at Jonah's preaching, and look, something greater than Jonah is here. So that's the idea. And you see this idea throughout. And we need to keep that in mind as we're looking at Matthew 8, saying, well, who's being contrasted? Is it people that believe a whole lot with people that have a little faith? Is it with people that have no faith? What you see in all these passages is a consistent problem. A generation of Jewish people that characteristically, not all of them, but characteristically rejects Jesus as the Christ. That's the problem he's dealing with, and he's dealing with it throughout this book, so much so that there's a turning point in Matthew 13. He starts preaching in parables. He's only teaching the kingdom to people that are already believers. He begins to talk in Matthew 16 about building his church, that sort of thing. Now, this passage at hand, Matthew 8, notice something else. It's about Jewish people not getting in the kingdom, and it's being preached to a group of people before the cross. If by chance you know this verse, this passage, were there to indicate that there's a group of people who are believers but will be excluded from some part of the kingdom and in a place called the outer darkness because their faith is small, if that's what's being taught, it's only being taught about Jewish people. There's no place in Matthew or anywhere else that suggests that it's true of Christians in the, you know, that become Christians in the church age. This is Jewish people before the cross. There's no place in Matthew or anywhere else that says it's true of any Gentiles. That's a curious, missing element if that view of it is taken. I think what helps is to step back for a second. We think of the outer darkness passages, but let's think of it as the gnashing of teeth passages. This is one of a handful of passages that relate to the gnashing of teeth. Now, this one relates outer darkness to gnashing of teeth, but this is a peculiar phrase. It's used in Matthew a handful of times, and once in Luke, that's it. I want to read those gnashing of teeth passages. They will also help us put a fence around what Matthew 8 is really speaking about. So we have the weeping and gnashing of teeth here in Matthew 8, for those thrown in outer darkness. Matthew 13:42. That's the chapter where Jesus first teaches in parables in the book of Matthew as it unfolds. He begins teaching the kingdom in parables, and he tells the parable of the wheat and tares, as it's called. And in Matthew 13:42, he says, "They will throw them," that's the tares, "in the blazing furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Now, those who take that view that the outer darkness is a temporary exclusion from the kingdom all agree that the Matthew 13 verse is hell, that they, the burning furnace, the blazing furnace, that's the lake of fire, and so the weeping and gnashing of teeth is associated with the torment of being in hell. I'm suggesting that the weeping and gnashing of teeth is used to describe the reaction of the people in every instance in exactly the same context. That is, they're being thrown into the lake of fire. It doesn't use the same words every time, but it's the exact same result which suggests the same cause. Let me read the other ones. Matthew 13:50, throw them into the blazing furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew 22:13. This is part of the second passage on the outer darkness, so we'll cover that one in detail in the next lesson, but it's a parable about a wedding. The king told the attendants, tie him up hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's difficult to understand this to be believers who were simply excluded for a period of time but ultimately get in the kingdom, why they're having to be tied in hand and foot and essentially forcibly removed from the wedding feast that's in view in that parable. In any event, that is the interpretation some are taking. They'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth there. Matthew 24:51, this is part of the Olivet Discourse. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. In that place, there will be weeping of gnashing of teeth. It's interesting that there's weeping of gnashing of teeth in the place where people are cut into pieces, in the place that's described as a burning furnace, and in the place described as outer darkness, if they're not all exactly the same place, given that we're reading all passages from the same gospel. And I suggest to you it is. The gnashing of teeth verses are all verses about hell. Matthew 25:30. This is the third and final passage on outer darkness that we'll deal with in a subsequent lesson. It's a parable of the talents, which I would just say here is not a parable about rewards. It's not a parable about being a good and faithful servant. But it's a difficult parable. We'll deal with it separately. But I want to read the gnashing of teeth verse. Matthew 25:30, and throw this good-for-nothing slave into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. One interpretation is the good-for-nothing slave is a believer who's not been fruitful. The other interpretation is it's a non-believer who is being placed in hell. Finally, Luke 13:28 does reference there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth in that place. When you see Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, but yourselves thrown out. Now, this suggests a complete exclusion from the kingdom. Think about this, too. All throughout Matthew, and really all the Gospels, there's talk of the kingdom, but there's never any discussion of like a separate millennial kingdom from the rest of it. I get that that's taught in the book of Revelation. I get that it talks about the first 1,000 years, then the new heavens, new earth. But when you read the Old Testament, the emphasis is on a kingdom that will last forever. You see that in Daniel 2, see it in Daniel 7, see it in the book of Zechariah. A permanent kingdom of Messiah. And yes, there's something about that first 1,000 years. It's a little different from what comes after, but it's one kingdom. And so the natural way in a Jewish mindset at this time, not having the book of Revelation, but looking back on the Old Testament passages, there's one kingdom that lasts forever. If you're excluded from it, you're excluded from something that lasts forever, which means you're excluded forever. Only a modern sort of a Gentile approach to say, maybe you're excluded for just a little bit of time. Two of these passages about outer darkness are clearly parables, the one in Matthew 22 and the one in Matthew 25. The language of Matthew 8 is very, very similar, but it's as if you got a piece of it without the whole parable. It seems to me that if the intent were to teach that some people who are believers will be in the kingdom, but they'll be excluded for some temporary amount of time, it is odd that instead of just having parables, we don't have a very clear, explicit teaching that that's the case. And it's odd that no other writer in the New Testament, none of the gospel writers, even hint at such an occurrence. This is one of those doctrines that would seem so significant, the idea of a Christian being excluded from some portion of the kingdom, that it wouldn't be sort of hidden in the corners, as it were, in some difficult parables, as opposed to something we might have read about in multiple places, especially because there's lots of other places where the issue of rewards and the negative consequences for being unfruitful are discussed, and none of them suggest being kept out of the kingdom for some period of time. Now, that all said, the other thing, that's why I read the gnashing of teeth verses, they're all judgment verses. And Matthew is a book that is talking about judgment, people being out of the kingdom, and it culminates in the Sermon on the Mount and in the teaching of Matthew 25. So I want to read that to you because, and then we'll go back to chapter 8 and try to tie this up. But in Matthew 25 and 24, Jesus teaches a series of parables, and they are addressed to really the Jewish generation that will be alive during the tribulation immediately before the return of Christ. And then it addresses in Matthew 25 the return of Christ, and then it addresses a judgment that's been mentioned in one way or another in multiple passages, including our outer darkness passages, leading up to it. When you get to this judgment, finally in Matthew 25, there's no parable. It's clear and it's straightforward. And what I really want you to see is this, that there's two options in this judgment. You're a sheep or you're a goat. For the outer darkness interpretation that some people are temporarily excluded from the kingdom, then they get in later, there really needs to be a third group of people, and there's not. Look at what it says. When you're in Matthew 25, after he finishes the sermon, or the message about the talents, you read this. When the Son of Man, this is verse 31, comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him. I take it that's everybody. And he will separate them one from another, just as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He'll put the sheep on his right and the goats on the left. And then the king will say to those on his right, come, you are blessed by my Father. Inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Now see that? The whole group that was set on his right-hand side, the sheep, they're all in. 100% of them. There's no reference to some of them being temporarily not in, but in later. Then you keep reading and he gives some explanation for why they're in, which is basically that they have responded favorably in faith. Now, he uses some different language, and I'll talk more about that in a couple of lessons. But what he's really saying is they've responded favorably to the message and had faith, and so they're in. Then he says in 25 verse 41, then he will also say to those on the left, these are the goats, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. And then he gives some explanation for why they're there. So, two options. And this is all I'm saying. You have a book that is speaking of faith throughout. And especially of a shocking circumstance that so much of that Jewish generation was faithless in the face of him doing messianic miracles, so much so that he says, you know, if these same miracles had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, okay, the worst group of Gentiles you can think of just about, they would have responded favorably, and in fact, they would have avoided the judgment you read about back in the book of Genesis. But this generation, by implication, will not, because they have had much more revelation. They've had the Messiah presenting these miracles, and they've, as a generation, rejected him. Not every individual, but characteristically of that generation. In addition, you have all these judgment passages, these gnashing of teeth passages, and it all culminates in a single judgment where you're either on the right-hand side or the left-hand side. Everybody on the right is in the kingdom. Everybody on the left is not. And that's it. So it's difficult to go to a passage in the middle somewhere and suggest that there's sheep, goats, and then sort of probationary sheep that will get in eventually after something not nice, not comfortable happens for some period of time. Let's look at Matthew 8 then, with this just kind of lots of background. But whatever interpretation you take, it has to make sense of the book, not just the sense of a few words. So let's talk about this. Why would people come to this and say, well, this has to be believers who are temporarily excluded? The main argument is that it refers to them as sons of the kingdom. So after Jesus says that this centurion had great faith, greater than he's found anywhere in Israel, he says, "I tell you that many will come from the east and west to share the banquet with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." So that reference to the sons of the kingdom, it's argued as a reference to saved people, because in Matthew 13, in the parable of the wheat and the tares, it appears that the phrase son of the kingdom is used in that way. It only occurs in two places, those two places. It's not a rabbinic term. It's not found in the Mishnah. It's not found in the Talmud. It is, as far as we know, it's just here. Now, there are some similar phrases, sons of the world to come, that will occur in some of the Jewish writings, but not this sons of the kingdom. And if you look in 13, when Jesus is interpreting the wheat and tares, he begins that in verse 36, but the part I want to read to you, he says, verse 37, "The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man, the field is the world, and the good seed, these are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the harvesters are angels. Therefore, just as the weeds are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be in the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels. They will gather from his kingdom all who cause sin and those guilty of lawlessness, throw them into the blazing furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in their Father's kingdom." Here, again, as with all the other judgments, there's just two groups. He doesn't call them sheep and goats, but it's the same story. One group gets burned up. One group is in the kingdom. But because the sons of the kingdom is clearly indicated here to be the good seed, an indicator that it's the believers, the argument is made that it has to be that the sons of the kingdom in Matthew 8 has the same meaning. There's no reason it has to follow. There's no reason at all that it has to mean exactly the same thing. I think the context of what's happening in Matthew 8 will have to drive how we take it. I would point out, for example, that those who would insist that the sons of the kingdom has to be mean the same thing will insist that the weeping and gnashing of teeth is not the same. One is weeping and gnashing because you're going to be out of the kingdom for a little while. The other is weeping and gnashing because you're in hell. That's a big difference. They'll say, well, that's different, but the sons of the kingdom is the same. It's inconsistent. There's no reason it has to be the same. What is being contrasted? The argument is made that what's being contrasted is a Gentile with great faith and some Jewish people who have mediocre faith. That doesn't make sense, and it's the reason that I wanted to talk about the gnashing of teeth passages, the judgment passages. What you see throughout this book is a judgment that separates into two groups. And what you see so early on in the passages I read from chapters 11 and 12 are a generation that's rejecting him and Jewish leadership that's rejecting him. What we should see here in Matthew 8 is Jesus has healed this leper. He's done a unique messianic miracle. He has sent this man to the Jewish leadership to be certified clean, a message to them that the Christ is here. But we know they're already rejecting him. And so it's natural when he's approached by this centurion who has such a great faith that he's making a contrast with finding great faith where you don't expect to find it, while finding no faith where you do expect to find great faith. He should have found great faith in Israel and on the whole found none. Okay? Not everybody, but characteristically. He doesn't expect to find a bunch of, I'm just saying a Jewish audience would not expect to find a bunch of believing Gentiles, and yet there are several instances in the Gospels and in here in Matthew of Gentiles who have, by Jesus' own words, great faith. And that's what you see here. That's the contrast. It's not a contrast between great faith and mediocre faith. It's between great faith, where you wouldn't expect it, and no faith, where you should have expected it. And that is why he says, you know, there's going to be some that are the sons of the kingdom who won't be in the kingdom. Why? Jewish people had a mindset that was wrong, and it was a belief that all Jewish people basically are in the kingdom, and generally they thought Gentiles were not. This is a very scandalous statement, that there would be Gentiles in the kingdom. Now, the Old Testament taught that. You can read the end of Zechariah 2, for example. It's in a lot of places. Nevertheless, you had this concept that, generally speaking, Gentiles are not in the kingdom. It's not for them. It's just for the Jewish people. And all the Jewish people, they're in. And it was a common belief among the Pharisees in particular that all Jewish people are in the kingdom. To be told that they're not, that there will be, quote, sons of the kingdom, those for whom the kingdom promises were given in the Old Testament, who won't be there. That's scandalous. And that's the contrast being made here. Those are the ones who are in the outer darkness. And the idea that the outer darkness can be anything other than exclusion from the kingdom permanently is at odds with the other judgment passages, and in particular, Matthew 25. The judgment will have sheep and goats. It will have those on the left and those on the right, none in the middle. That's the problem with the outer darkness here. So, we'll finish it there. And in the next lesson, we will go through the parable in Matthew 22. In the third lesson, I'll try to cover the parable of talents in Matthew 25. I will say this. You don't have a whole lot of data to work with in the immediate context of Matthew 8. It's a short passage. The Matthew 22 passage is much more detailed, and the Matthew 25 even more. To really come to a final decision, well, what's Matthew talking about? You got to go through all three of them very carefully. So, in a big sense, this is not anywhere near a complete defense of my view that outer darkness is ultimately hell. It is basically part one. You really got to get through those other two, and you really got to see how it all culminates. And that parable of the talents is widely misunderstood. When you properly understand it, it becomes very apparent again that the outer darkness is effectively the same as that final judgment with the sheep and the goats, and they are the goats. So God bless you, and we'll see you next time.